And the question is always, are we happy with meat's expectations, or can we learn something from those countries that do something, that add that extra 25% that in the long term makes for a big difference?
So just how fast is my internet connection? That question might be on your lips if you've been following any of the technology news going on in the US in the past couple weeks. Last week, Google announced that some lucky towns in the States would be getting a Google-sponsored extreme web makeover, offering speeds of up to 1 gigabit per second to some 500,000 Americans. Not to be outdone, the Federal Communications Commission announced their 100 Squared plan this week to bring 100 megabit per second broadband speeds to 100 million American homes. And this past Tuesday, the Berkman Center dropped its final report on broadband internet around the world. Commissioned by the FCC, the 333-page report is an exhaustive study in comparisons, showing just how the U.S. stacks up among 30 industrial nations when it comes to internet speeds, penetration, and prices for both mobile and wired internet, and the policies that got them there. The results? Turns out, the U.S. is roughly in the middle in nearly all measures. Our internet speed averages about 4 megabits per second, meaning it would take somewhere around 40 minutes for you to download a typical episode of American Idol in HD. How does that compare? Well, that same episode in South Korea would take you only 10 minutes. In fact, with 100 megabits per second costing less than $50 a month, many South Koreans could be staring at Simon Cowell's mug in HD in under a minute. Of course, our thirst for high-speed internet goes beyond just watching singers embarrassing themselves on our laptops and smartphones. When the FCC announced their national broadband plan last April, they made it clear that high-speed internet is going to fundamentally change how the U.S. competes in the world. With applications from business to education, to medicine, to energy and public safety, high-speed internet is poised to revolutionize how we communicate. For now, it's just a matter of implementing the right policy to get us there, and we'll see how the FCC's plan fares when it hits the floor of Congress on March 17th. You can find a link to the Berkman Center report, Next Generation Connectivity, a review of broadband internet transitions and policy from around the world, on our show notes at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. The report's principal investigator, Yochai Binkler, sat down with David Weinberger last week to give us a glimpse into how he and his team collected their data and what lessons we should learn from other countries.
One of the many things we did in our study that was using cities was actually looking at the top city, the largest city, and the capital in each of these countries. What we found was that New York, for example, is not a top 20 city in terms of actual speeds measured. Washington, D.C. is not a top 30 city. Instead, what you get is cities, the two cities in countries that more generally have higher speeds, like Lyon in France or Gothenburg in Sweden or Espoo in Finland. These are the cities that were ahead of New York in terms of download speeds. The U.S. is not in a disaster zone, but is quite middling overall in speeds, in prices. Prices are somewhere between middling and actually quite high, as the higher the speed that you get, the more expensive the U.S. is relative to other countries. And then we looked, obviously, at the standard measures that everybody knows, at the penetration. When you look at formal statistical agencies' reports and surveys for penetration per household, again, the U.S. is about 15th. Some other countries move up and down to some extent, but not the U.S.
So you're doing this study in a field in which there's been enormous controversy and large differences in findings about the standing of the U.S. relative to other countries in terms of how many people have access to broadband, how fast the broadband is, and the cost of it. How, if you're, when you're designing a study like this, how do you get rid of the elements that are causing this variance in results?
So the primary thing that we did was really try to find different measures of the same observation and try to compare them. And if you find from different sources similar results, that gives you a higher level of confidence that they're correct. Now, there are lots of different benchmarks and measures. One of the things we did in the report was to actually do a short overview of what are the different kinds of benchmarks. And essentially, we found that there are two families that are the benchmarks, the benchmarking exercises that say the U.S. is somewhere between 1 and 3. And those are heavily weighted towards business use and business infrastructure and business investment. That is to say, how much is invested in software and things like that. There, the U.S. is doing quite well. But even in those benchmarks, when you look at the measures that reflect household access and availability, the U.S. drops to where we find it in measures like the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU, or the OECD, which is to say, in penetration, that is to say, how many people have access, about 15th of 30. But because this has been something that's been so contested for so long, because we all know in some sense that the U.S. was fourth in 2002 and is now 15th, that's been the target of intense efforts to undermine it from people who don't like the result. One of the things, for example, that people often talk about is say, well, if you look at penetration per capita, it's going down, but penetration per households, we're doing fine. It turns out when you look at penetration per households, we're exactly the same 15th spot that we were in penetration per 100. If you use the official Census Bureau materials, if you start poking around and looking, I want from this particular source for this and from that particular source for the other, you can come up with more flattering positions. But that's not a real way to do policy. The OECD, in some sense, is the best set of metrics because the countries, relatively speaking, are democratic, market-based, relatively wealthy. In that regard, they're the closest comparators in the world. It's a well-stabilized organization that gets information directly from the national regulatory agencies, from the national statistics agencies. It's in some senses the gold standard of the data collection on economic issues. But we weren't only focused on that. So, for example, speed is a classic example where we did this. So the OECD collects data on advertised speeds and had a very minimal effort to do actual speeds. But then we had added to that two additional completely different kinds of measurement approaches. One was looking at Akamai's State of the Internet report, which is data that's done by a third party, not the carrier or the end user, in the network, topologically in the network. And that found, we compared all of that for end of 2008, because that was a period for which we had both advertised data and speed test measurement at the edges and Akamai. And there the US comes out 11th among the OECD countries. Then we also use data from a company called Ookla, which I think people know more as speedtest.net. And that's at the edges, what the individual user experiences when they run an app and get back what their speed is. Again, the US was 11th. So when you get these different sources, when you get on one hand one company measuring in the network, another company measuring at the end user, and they come out with such a high correlation as these did, that's another way in which we get confident to say, you know what, American average speeds, 11th is about right. It might be one more, it might be one less, but that's roughly right. It's certainly not a big mistake. Similarly, we did a pricing study. Again, most of the debate in the U.S. focuses on penetration because that's been sort of the major political hot button. But I think some of the things we did, which were more interesting, were, again, the speed and the prices. And what we found was that at very low speed, 768 kilobits per second, the U.S. has very attractive prices. Once you hit speeds of between 2 to 10 megabits, the U.S. is already relatively high-priced, middle of the 30 countries. And once you move to high prices, 10 megabits and above, we're 18th, or in the case of very high speeds, next generation speeds from about 30 for above 35 megabits, we're 19th of 19. So essentially, the picture that we get from pricing, because we use OECD data, two completely different market data, we get multiple insights, each of which corresponds and correlates with the other, suggesting to us, if you look from here, if you look from there, if you look from the third place, the results are very similar. And the results are not attractive.
So having used multiple sources of data so that you don't have to rely upon a single one that makes particular, maybe skewed in a particular direction, what do you make of the picture? Why is it that, in general, the U.S. is in the middle of the pack? Why is Espoo Finland beating us?
Well, so why is a very complex question. I think one of the problems we've had is that there have been debates of even being willing to look at the image in the mirror and accept that, in fact, it's not a fantastic picture, Before we start talking about reasons, just let's look at the picture. And the picture is a very middling one, not one that we, understanding ourselves as in the US, would like to see ourselves in that position. The next question, as you say, is why? And why is a complex problem? It has lots of different determinants. The thing that we found that was most important is that it looks like the answer is competition. That is to say, how much competition there is in a market, whether or not we're looking at markets that have only at most two players, a cable company versus a telephone company, or whether we have markets that have a telephone company, a cable company, and this is the critical point, various other kinds of entrants. So in Korea specifically, it's the electric utility and some issues in Japan with fiber as well. But the thing that's surprising, or that policy really can make a difference on, is that we also have entrants that came in using open access. The idea of open access is quite simple. The basic idea is it's very expensive to hire backhoes and people to dig trenches, pull ducts, pull wires, make holes in walls, and push walls. None of these are very high-tech activities, but they're enormously expensive. If you make the price of entry into the market, into broadband delivery, being able to invest that much, you limit the number of companies that can enter the market without going bankrupt. Maybe you can have one. If you're lucky and you're in a dense area that's relatively wealthy, you might be able to sustain two. You're not going to be able to sustain three, four, five, six. You probably don't want more than that in these kinds of markets, but three to five, when you look at Finland, for example, when you look at Sweden, when you look at Japan, when you look at France, it's more like three to four. Those are the markets that seem to have more players. And they mix and match some cable, some incumbent telco, and some companies that are basically coming and using the facilities of the incumbent companies at a regulated rate. They then invest their own electronics, they invest their own services, but they're able to share to rent at a regulated rate the ducts, the copper, the things that are slow moving, exist for years, and account for, in some cases, 85% of the cost of laying a network. And open access is an approach that the U.S. adopted almost unanimously in Congress in 96, and that was run from 96 to 2001, 2002, and that we abandoned in 2001, 2002 in favor of the idea that it's enough to have competition between one cable carrier and one telco carrier.
So if from 1996 to 2001 the U.S. had open access, then there should be some data indicating a change perhaps in our standing or the penetration, price, speed, all those things, presumably.
It is true that the U.S. in 2001 was fourth in broadband penetration and in high-speed internet, as it was measured at the time, which is very different from how it's measured now, had the best prices in the world. And that today we're 15th and 19th, say, by those comparisons. I worry a bit about making that close of a connection because there are lots of complex components that go in, and people, and one of the things that we did in this report is actually do a very careful, thorough analysis of all of the econometrics literature from the last decade that tries to explain this away. And we came away very skeptical of the quality of the work and of the really deep difficulties of extracting econometrically valid statements by cross-country comparisons of 30 or 27 countries. There's heavy pollution by industry-funded research. There's heavy role for self-published and not peer-reviewed materials in a context that's extremely difficult to do well. In some other disciplines, like growth economics, people no longer even use these kinds of cross-country econometric studies. What are we left with, essentially, other than raising our hands? What we're left with is, first of all, looking at the facts. Compare the prices, compare the speeds, compare the penetration, and see which countries systematically do well. And the next thing, which is what we did and also what we reviewed in the literature, go in, learn about the country. What is the political economy? How is it regulated? What is the structure of the market? When did firms go in and go out? When did they invest? When did they not invest? What's available to consumers? What isn't? Much, much richer qualitative work. And that's where we came out and we said, you know what? When you look at these countries carefully, what you find is that when you have a regulator that's willing to say to the national incumbent, you have to share your facilities. You've invested in copper for years, but now there's a new entrant, whoever it happens to be in the different country, you have to rent them out the facilities so that they can bring their own electronics, connect it to the copper without bringing in backhoes and spending all of the labor costs all over again, so that they can enter. That's where you get those competitive markets. And unsurprisingly, from competition, you get better prices, higher speeds. And again, there's nothing mysterious about the consumers here. You give people higher speeds for lower prices, they buy more of the thing. There's no mystery.
The most common explanation for our standing that that I hear, when you say, well, we're in the middle of the pack, we're 15th, or sometimes it's 19th, depending on who you're listening to, somebody will say, well, it's density. Those countries that are that have greater penetration, it's because the people are packed together more tightly. You actually looked at that.
Density alone doesn't do the explanation. It explains some, particularly degree of urban concentration. But Sweden is not more dense than the U.S. Finland is not necessarily more dense than the U.S. It's not higher necessarily on urban concentration. What's critical, though, and this we find again and again, in many of these studies that try to say, well, it's density and education and this, that, the other, is that even the ones that try to explain away as everything, and what you find is that again and again, the same set of countries overperform relative to what it is that we predict, as opposed to meeting expectations. And what you found, and this was very much in the comments to our original draft that came, people say, well, the U.S. meets expectation. Here, let me run a regression, which has all of the problems of the multi-country, cross-country comparisons that we spend pages on pages explaining exactly why these are very, very problematic studies. And all of these studies about the implications of density or wealth or education have the same set of problems. But all of them come and say, here's a predicted rate. And see, the U.S. is exactly on the predicted rate. And the thing to remember is what that means is the U.S. meets expectations. Are we a meets expectations country? That's the question. Because there is a set of consistent above expectations countries. Korea, even with density, is above expectations. Japan is above expectations. Denmark, the Netherlands, these are above expectations countries, irrespective of questions like density. And the question is always, are we happy with meets expectations, or can we learn something from those countries that do something, that add that extra 25% that in the long term makes for a big difference? And that's, I think, what we were trying to do in the looking at every country, looking at every firm, trying to understand what is it that happened in this country that allowed them to do better than their natural endowment.
So what is it that we should be doing?
So one of the ways in which we were misunderstood, either purposefully or otherwise, when the first draft came around, was the thought that what we said was bring back the 96 Act, lock, stock, and barrel without any change. That's not what anybody is doing. What all of the other countries that have done well with open access policies, and again, the thing to remember, open access policies at this point have been adopted in all the OECD countries except for the U.S., Mexico and Slovakia. And Mexico and Slovakia, particularly Mexico, is not doing particularly well in terms of penetration. Slovakia, in terms of penetration, so-so. And the U.S. less than it can be or should be. The thing that we found was that countries now faced with the transition to next generation are drawing on the wealth of experience in open access to try to think, how do they solve the next round? And the next big challenge is fiber to the home. Massive natural monopoly, massively expensive. In the U.S., we love to point out the fact that we have very high fiber to the home, 4%. What we don't focus on is that entire 4%, or almost that entire 4%, comes from Verizon. Then there are about another 1,000 or more small providers that have, on average, 1,600 fiber connections at all. Neither AT&T nor Quest are doing fiber to the home. Why? Because it's enormously expensive. It costs somewhere between $1,500 and $2,500 bucks per fiber to the home connected subscriber. If you're delivering roughly the same thing, but it costs you 20, 25 times more to deliver it, you're in a rough situation competitively. And AT&T and Quest haven't gone down that line. Verizon has. What we're seeing, particularly in Europe, is that that lesson is being learned by all of these companies, by all of these countries. It is possible to share the cost of that incredibly expensive backhoes and people expense of pulling fiber to the home. It is possible to share those risks and then compete on a shared platform. And there's a wide range of options for doing that. And it ranges all the way from the Australian model. The government is now planning to fund it all, build it all, and then privatize it under a fully open access utility-like model, through much more municipal-based open access with separating the pure carriage from the services, which we see in Sweden, which we may be seeing in the UK moving forward, all the way to completely voluntary solutions in the Netherlands and Switzerland, where essentially you see the incumbents coming together and saying, you know what, let's collaborate with our competitors, or in the Netherlands, it's with a real estate firm. Let's build the fiber in a way that it's like commercial real estate. We're going to pull it to the home. Then we're going to rent it out open access, very similar to what Google was putting on the table just this week. Let's pull it to the home. Let's share the fibers on an open access basis, but let's do it as a business proposition. So what we see today is that throughout Europe, there's a range of options ranging from highly regulated to completely voluntary, all of which share this core framework. It's extremely expensive to get fiber to the home. In order to do it, we're best off sharing risks and costs and then engaging in some framework that allows us to share the slow-moving components and compete on the fast-moving electronics, optics, services. I think what we need to do in the U.S. is to say, what's the state of our competition? We have a framework that allows us to have two players, cable company and telephone company. In about 15% of the country, Verizon has chosen to go fiber to the home. That means we'll continue to have at most two. In the rest of the country, for really next-generation speeds, we're really looking at one, at the cable platform option. We're not seeing it from AT&T and Quest. They're using basically a version of DSL, even when it's branded as fiber. So essentially, what we're looking at best, duopoly markets. Instead, we should be starting right now a process. I don't know if it's an 18-month process or a 24-month process, to look at the wide range of options, at which are the ones that would most fit the particular market structure we have, so that we can actually get a competitive market, that American consumers can see competition regionally, effectively, where it's there, not between one or two players, but between three, four, five, and then move forward from there. But the first thing to do is to recognize that we, in fact, are in a condition that is quite middling relative to our abilities. And that we can, and that there's a class of solutions that has been applied both in the past successfully and is currently at the centerpiece of next generation planning in those countries that over the last 7 to 8 years have surpassed us.
Most of those ways of getting to open access require policy changes, but not a lot of tech or any technology changes. Is that correct?
Yes, the primary focus here was, in our study certainly, was not let us come out with a call to the technology companies to be more innovative, but rather, given the trajectory, the technological trajectory that we have, what can we improve in the level of policy? So in this regard, what it requires is for the FCC to look at the evidence, to ask itself and to ask the American public, is it okay that when you look at next generation speeds, we have the highest prices? And if not, to see what can we do to move forward. So I think one of the first things that would enable any of this to happen is for the FCC to go back and say, We've made the choice. We're the only country in the world that has basically said, because broadband providers are bundling both the carriage and the internet access, we're just going to call it all information services. But instead, we should go back and say, why, actually? Why shouldn't we adopt Justice Scalia's position that says carrying bits is carriage and giving information services? Even if the same company does them, they're two separate things. Once you do that, you build a lot more flexibility for the FCC within the context of congressional constraints in the Telecommunications Act to provide safeguards for competitors that are sharing facilities.
What would that do to Verizon and AT&T and Qwest and the others? How would that restructure them?
The primary thing that it would do for those companies is it would open the possibility for each of them to become a national company bundling fiber with mobile, with TV, etc. At the moment, they're very much large regional companies, but regionalized in duopoly markets. And in the case of AT&T and Qwest, they're really regionalized with a slow phase out away from really having a wired solution. And what you have now are their national wireless companies, but regional wired companies. And one of the things we've seen everywhere in the most advanced countries, is continuing convergence between mobile and fixed, because in order to get ubiquitous access, you really need both. And we're seeing some very creative things happening in France, in particular, nomadic access, Wi-Fi access, essentially SFR and Free, two of the innovative companies that are about half the market in France, are basically using all of their end consumers' boxes, service boxes, as Wi-Fi nodes, so that when you're anywhere within the range of another subscriber of your own company, you can connect using their Wi-Fi box. And SFR actually integrates that also with their mobile broadband network. So if you've got your iPhone up and your SFR, the iPhone will look around and say, if I'm close to another subscriber, I'll use their Wi-Fi. And if not, I'll go to the 3G cell tower. A lot of creativity going on there. Essentially, it would strategically allow, just like AT&T was trying to compete before the FCC changed its policy between 2002 and 2005, AT&T was competing as an entrant, as a long-distance entrant into each of these markets. Once the FCC flipped, SBC bought AT&T and you get the new AT&T because there's no opportunity to compete nationally. So what this does is it opens up for them the market to compete nationally. It requires a very different conception of size of market and margins and controlling your duopoly as opposed to being in a more competitive market. Still not 100 firms. It's still going to be 3 or 4 nationally. But it allows them to use the fact that they have this mobile advantage, but then also access in fiber to really become these national converged companies, which will again then put pressure on cable to integrate some model of mobile as well. So it would change things quite significantly for all of these companies in terms of broadening the range of places they could play, but potentially lowering the margins in each of these places. And that's a big trade-off.
How hopeful are you?
On what dimension?
How hopeful are you that the U.S. will make the policy changes necessary in order to get us past expectation?
It's very hard to predict at the moment. One thing that we found out when our draft report was put up for comment by the FCC is that it's an enormously controversial proposition. There are several companies who have several hundred billion dollars a year worth of revenues between them from an industry that is not particularly competitive. There's a set of proposals and comparisons to countries that have more competitive markets. Our usual way of thinking about competition is that it extracts rents from non-competitive players and improves the welfare of consumers at a minimum and of society more generally. That means if you're the person who's currently collecting rents, that you're going to lose some of those rents. So there's enormous resistance, and we've already seen it in the kind of responses to our initial finding. The politics are hard. It will require political will on the part of this FCC. It's a very well-staffed FCC. It's very intelligently run. Clearly, the issue of making sure that the U.S. is not 15th or 19th is something the president has spoken about. It's something the new chairman of the FCC has spoken about. The conditions are certainly more favorable than they have been in a very long time. But it's still an uphill battle politically. The question to my mind is whether we'll figure things out now or whether 5, 6, 7 years down the line, when we have a monopoly in most of the country and next generation, when we've fallen further behind, we look around and we say, we simply can't afford not to be a leading nation in broadband connectivity. That's the question. Will it happen today? Will it happen in 5 years? Will it happen too late?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yochai Binkler is the principal investigator behind the report Next Generation Connectivity, a review of broadband internet transitions and policy from around the world. You can find a download of that report on our website, along with a link to uncut video of David Weinberger's interview with Yochai on our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This week's episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger and Seth Young from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.